Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
McGill.
Now, McGill, this is episode 159, and we're recording on the 16th of August, 2023. I understand you've been a bit busy with people coming and going. It's been an eventful summer for both of us, I think.
Certainly has.
Now, we had talked about, I had just listened to the episode recently where we talk about the game The Gates. And I know that we keep putting this off. We keep meaning to do it. And so I saw that you were busy again. And I was like, oh, man, I bet this is another week we're not doing The Gates. But then I saw what you said in the notes that we are doing. And I was like, oh, what's this? I looked it up. And, man, I could not be more excited for what this game is.
Yeah, I had this feeling where, sure enough, we're not doing The Gates. But I was like, I got to bring something else. I got to bring something cool that Tom's going to like. And I found a pretty easy one to understand. But what a great fun premise it is.
All right. Well, let's get on with it so we don't keep the audience in suspense. I mean, once again, continuing the story of Coyote's Aegis. With our party last time, we covered a night of downtime before the Draelic army mobilizes in Agaloc. We're on the cusp of some big things we had covered at the end of last time. And, yeah, should we start with me then?
Yeah, let's get into yours.
Okay, so, Hex went home. Connor had a religious experience. And Gent made a crazy mystery wall. And Chantel said they will be found sleeping entangled in the red string. And I said, all right, well, speaking of sleeping in a tangle of red string, Gent, you're back in the forest again. You see the tree up ahead, but this time the blackbird comes to you. Swooping down from its perch in the tree branches above, it lands dramatically before you, wings pressed to the ground like a cape. As it rises, you see that it has grown larger still, now approaching the size of a vulture. Its black feathers shine like polished obsidian in the moonlight, and its eyes have an eerie green glow that radiates past their pure milky whiteness. Again, on each foot, six talons can be seen digging into the ground. Oddly, you get the sense that if this bird's notable features were applied to a Kenku, you would find them quite attractive. The bird gazes at you quizzically. And they roll an unnatural 20 for insight, and I say, you realize you are dreaming and may choose to wake up if you wish. And Gent asks, do you know who I am? And in this lucid dreaming state, Gent's immediate memories regarding what they've learned about Gratz are easily accessible. And the bird nods and chirps, Gent! And Chantel says, fuck. And Gent says, do you know where I am? And it stretches out its wings a bit and begins to gaze around its surroundings. Looking back to Gent, it settles again, then shrugs. And then Gent says, see you, and wakes up. And Chantel basically explains, I just wanted to know if he was somehow watching me, but I'll be prepared next time. And after a perception roll of 24, they wake up aware of a faint after scent of wood smoke. And they say, musky, and the scent soon fades. And Chantel says, I will grab the rod, and go to where I know Hex and Connor will be coming back, and I will pace while I wait. And the following morning, Hex, Aquila, and Connor, and Gent, they all gather for another classic Hex, Aquila breakfast, knowing the day will likely be a long one. And I ask what Hex prepares, and he says, probably just make a whole bunch of bread. Nice focaccia bread. I assume that's how you pronounce that. Focaccia. F-O-C-A-C-C-I-A. In case anyone's wondering.
Focaccia.
Focaccia.
Right?
Yeah. And then I say basically Jen can intercept the others immediately or talk to them over breakfast. Either way, They're on Omega Base. And Chantel says, cool. While Hex is making bread, Jen is going to ramble at breakneck speed the following information. It's demons, man. But one in particular. Maybe more. Someone had to have had us... Someone may have had us do some dirty work. Gratz. Kind of hot. But doesn't watch me. But knows me. You know? And Connor will think to himself for some time before slowly asking, how? And, Jen says, the illithid we took out in the caves and sixes everywhere, and this thing. And they slam the rod on the table, and Connor relates his vision of Citra Akra overlaid over Drail and delicately mentions Paylor's words. And Jen says, I have some dreams and a wall of clues. You can see my wall of clues, but no comment on my button piles. They are organized just so. And the tentacles of the rod dance playfully as it sits on the table. And I get everyone to roll insight. Hex slams his loaves in the oven and turns. Well, this just got a lot more complicated. So there are demons in Agalok and demons in Citra Akra, and they are potentially working for Gratz, who might have his eye on us. And Gratz is like a demon king. And Gent rolls a nat 20 on that insight. An idea occurs to Gent. You have the ability to try and contact gut bones via the sending crystal. And Jen shares that idea. And I say, last you saw him was in Citra Akra, but he may be able to shed some light on the situation. And do you ever do that? Is like have everyone roll an insight check to just like see if they get like a little clue?
Yeah, sometimes. Usually I'll do that if a player prompts me for information. Or they're like, do I know anything about, like, any general knowledge about the region we're in or something like that? And I'll just have them roll insight and then feed them whatever info I want.
It's definitely something where, like, because you only roll when there is a matter of risk involved in Forged in the Dark, much more often I will simply volunteer the information if I think it will lead to a cool scene. I'll be like, you know, on that note... It occurs to you, but with Dungeons and Dragons, I don't know. I usually, if it's like a memory-based thing that the players are not coming up with themselves, I don't want to be holding their hand and leading them to the scene so much, and so I leave it up to like an insight check as if it's memory-based. Hex says, seems like a good idea, but let's not tip our hand too much here. We know Lord Dio had a deal with Citra Akra. Let's just call him up and ask how he's doing. Maybe ask about, like, our matchmaking clients? Jen says, we can do that. I may leave the asking to one of you two. And, Hex decides that he's gonna lead this one, and he, sets up the sending crystal, and the message, he says the message is as follows. Hey Gutbones, it's your friends from Chessie's Cupids. We were wondering how things are in Citra Akra. Is love still in the air? And in attempting to establish a connection to Gutbones' sending contact, the crystal becomes fogged up with static like a bad satellite signal. They've got the sending crystal and they've opened a channel to Gutbones, but it's like a snow crash satellite signal, but it begins displaying text in response to their inquiry about Chessie's Cupids. Waging civil war in Citra Akra. Moloch and Lorelei grateful for match. Moloch has sword to give you, should you ever return. You left bad impression in Larvae. Maybe don't visit there. And,
That's right, we are going back to Larvae, though.
Yeah, Hex follows up, civil war? That's no good. Hopefully not over the surrender. And the response is, no, over demon invasion. Corruption and possession rampant. Omnilich failing to correct. Falls to individuals like me to enact change. And Hex says, sounds like we have a common problem, although our side of it is a little more localized. Good luck. And Gutbone says, and to you. And Gent says, maybe we should ask him something only he would know. Make sure it's him. And Alex said, hey, send that emoji you like, ribcage.png. I attempted to create by doing a capital E. Like straight line and then a three.
It wouldn't be dot gif where he the gif
yeah.
animation does his
yeah,
trademark
exactly.
move
full one of those animated stickers. After that little aside, Alex is like, but maybe more seriously, I don't doubt it's him. Who else would know about our matchmaking experience? And they're like, fair. And then Alex says the classic line, we can never go back to Larvae. To which I said, Act 6, back to Larvae. Which was not entirely a lie. And Jent, just for clarity.
So that wasn't even the announcement.
No, not even. It was just like, you guys are going to get it.
A joke, but you were foreshadowing.
Yeah, kind of. And Chantel was like, was that the place we sold the factory to multiple people? And we're all like, yep. And followed by just like a series of ha 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 ha. Yeah, awkward. And Connor suggests maybe it's time to have the armory look at this flail. He points at it and the tentacles shrink away from him. And Hex says, that seems ominous. It shies away from our priest. And Jent says, okay, but what if we don't? Hear me out. This is our best connection to the six-toed crow. If we don't have the rod, then we don't have a way to possibly get more intel. Also, we would be breaking Kenku law and turning it in. And Connor says, that is a fair point. Or the first one, anyway. So the second point is made up. Hex says, certainly, maybe we could bring it to someone we trust. A wizard we know who could give it a quick scan and then keep quiet. Do we know anybody like that? I feel like we shouldn't show up at Axe School with a demonic artifact. He'd probably be embarrassed. That's, Hex's adopted son. That is a funny scenario to imagine, though, is like, the adopted son is at school one day and suddenly his, like, adoptive father shows up with, like, a cursed artifact and everybody's like, man, I heard that guy's dad brought a cursed artifact to the school.
Yeah, it probably happens all the time in D&D, though. In D&D
schools.
Yeah,
probably. And Hex says, what about our Archmage friend from the Arctopus? He could probably take a look. And I say, it should be said you can have the item identified and examined at the armory without turning it in for them to keep. But I point out, I provide a portrait for reference of Elm, the Elven Archmage.
Is this from that George Washington cartoon again?
Yeah, Liberty's Kids or whatever. It's great. It's full of great, simple portraits that you can use for characters. And, actually, I don't know if we've even talked about this on the podcast yet. Liberty's Kids, I think we talked about it in,
Did we talk about it offline? I thought we talked about
when we were playing Teeth. So for our listeners, right. Liberty's Kids is a cartoon from 2002. It was produced by Deke. And it's like, it's a show. It's like a history show. It's like a cartoon for kids that is, about like the American Revolution. Like these characters, these kids are just like always around at like major events, and it just like has everybody as a friggin' voice. It we got Sylvester Stallone as Paul Revere, Ben Stiller as Thomas Jefferson, Billy Crystal as John Adams, Annette Bening as Abigail Adams, Dustin Hoffman as Benedict Arnold, Michael Douglas as Patrick Henry, Arnold Schwarzenegger as Baron von Steuben, Liam Neeson as John Paul Jones, Whoopi Goldberg as Denver Simpson, Charles Shaughnessy as King George III, Michael York as Admiral Lord Richard Howe, Ray Fiennes as General Lord Charles Cornwallis, Don Francisco as Bernard de Galvez, etc., etc. Like, it just, when McGill says that George Washington show, it's like, man, it's so much more than that. It's just, it was like, I don't know.
I should have been more specific, but you knew immediately.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's Liberty's Kids. If people want to look it up, stylized on screen as Liberty's Kids established 1776. Cool. That reminds me of that fucking G.I. Joe clip with the YouTube comment that said, 1776. Great reference. Too funny. Yeah. So, 40 episodes there were of it. But let's get back to business. So Hex says, well, this is your thing, Gent. What do you think? And I say, to clarify, Gent doesn't know Elm. He was an archmage the party worked with when they were on the Arctopus while Gent was at college. And Gent says, I think we need to be careful with who we talk to. The Illithid mission does not fit. If you like Elm, I will trust your lead. My only experts are ones on buttons. And Alex says, honestly, or Hex says, honestly, I think our best bet is with Al-Samasath. I think he's the most trustworthy of our options. I agree with not telling Alistair about it. And he says, we could talk to Dax, but Al has been with the MPOC from the start. Dax has goblin market connections, and Alistair consorts with devils. I point out there's also an issue of getting in touch with Alistair. The more time passes, the less you have to follow up on these leads. And even teleporting from Omega Base to Arctopus and getting to Elm wouldn't be terribly convenient, to say nothing of whatever you'd have to do to contact Alistair, who's in hell. Al-Samasath and Dax are both on the base in the same spot, though, so that wouldn't be difficult. And so Hex votes for Al, and then the party resolves to go to the Armory and Labs to go consult with Al-Samasath. And I guess, like, now I can say, because it's been revealed in canon, is, like, it's funny that they're saying all this stuff about, like, Al-Samasath is their most trustworthy contact, because in reality, Al-Samasath is a minister.
A minister?
He's got a ministry parasite.
Little do they know.
He's been compromised as well. He's as compromised as anyone. So, on their way to the labs and armory, they soon find themselves following a string of Draelic laborers carrying what appear to be aluminum canisters, each about the size of a pickle jar. Upon reaching their destination, they can see a large collection of these canisters collected in front of the labs, with Wenton, Elianu, and Al-Samasath all placing more out for retrieval. The armory, on the other hand, is relatively quiet. They can see from the protective screen where they interact with Dax that a lot of crates and firearms have been cleared out, likely moved to support the upcoming war effort in Agalloch. And Hex says, did they get into preserves? They better not be holding out on me with jam, and Hex mutters to himself. And he says, how you doing, Al? Got a sec? We could use a word, privately. And, you know, I'll just say, as a little behind-the-screen DM, what I was setting up there is that is all the brain cap samples that are being prepared for the army that they are going to need in the Forest of Agalloch so that the soldiers don't go insane. They're going to need to be taking regular daily doses or like, you know, there's a limit to how much brain caps you can take or else it like messes with your brain. But, you know, having this huge military force in Agalloch, one of the big problems is going to be like the forest is like causing an inherent amount of like magical madness. And so the soldiers periodically have to be like dosed with these brain cap mushrooms to like keep them from going crazy. So that's what's in these containers, about the size of pickle jars. It's especially prepared brain caps. And Al sets down one of the containers and walks over to the group. Sure, things are a bit busy around here. What's up? And Gent says, we may have procured something and need consultation. He says, okay. And looks over to the armory. And you don't want Dax involved, I guess? And Hex says, trying to approach this one a little cautiously. Something's up. And Al-Samasath nods and he says, let's get some fresh air. And he leads them out through the corridors and through an exit to the base's larger open campus. He says, I'll do my best now, but keep in mind, Dax has more of an encyclopedic knowledge of any items you may have found. He takes them over to the docks, which are loud with the commotion of ships and crews heading off. A little ways away, he stops and he says, all right, should be good here. Gent shows him the rod and says, we are noticing a pattern of demonic involvement, and this seems to have a connection. And Al looks it over. Looks like an oversized tentacle rod to me, like the drow use. I thought they were smaller, though. He examines it and says, so what do you want to know? And Hex says, how could this thing relate to, say, a demonic invasion from Citra Akra, or spooky visions of six-clawed birds? And Al stares at him wide-eyed for a moment and then says, Honestly, I can't think of the Citra-Akra connection or even the demon one, but six-clawed birds, you say? And he says, yeah, also there's the circumstance by which we came by it. Did you ever work with Alistair? And he says, yep, back in Goblin Town, him and the rest of Empok's finest helped us rescue the Goblin Princess Remy. Why do you ask? That's an old shout out to longtime listeners of the podcast. They're going to be like, hey, I remember that. Reference.
Gosh, I hope we have listeners who get that.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. At least I have one listener who gets that. Muggil. So,
not me.
You remember Al Samasathi.
I do remember it. I just couldn't resist.
Goblin Princess Remy. Couldn't resist biting my rhymes. Okay. And so Hex explains, he asked us to investigate a possible Nightside holdout, but it wasn't Nightside, it was an Illithid den. This is another one of those things where it's like, he starts saying something, but then in brackets, I'm like, actually, I'm not sure that's right. I think you're getting confused. And he's like, okay. Right, so Al Samasath is like, says like, yeah, I've worked with Alistair back when we rescued Princess Remy. And he tries to like they tell him basically that Alistair sent them on this job to like take out this Illithid, and that's how they got this rod. And Al tries to think hard on this for a bit, but after a while he shakes his head. Honestly, I don't know. I feel like I'm missing something. You say you're worried about a demonic connection, but what does that have to do with Alistair sending you after an Illithid for that thing? And he says, I guess, Al says, we had one of those tentacle rods I mentioned in the Pandemonic Goblin archives. Again, this one seems bigger, but I don't know if that helps. And Hex says, there were also others, strange creatures I had not encountered before, fearsome warriors. They seemed to be exploring the den with us, but proved beyond cooperation. Did you have some insights as to the six-toed bird? And Al Samasath is like, not particularly. Honestly, it's all a bit much at once. I guess he thinks a bit. Alistair sent you after the Illithid. The Illithid had this. Well, what's the demon connection? And Gent says, and the presence of demons on every mission, demon iconography where we found this thing. Okay, that's something. Alistair is dedicated to Mephisto, a devil, right? So devils are enemies of demons, so it makes sense that Alistair would ask for help dealing with demons in some way. But I don't know why he'd send you after an Illithid if he was working against demons. What kind of demonic iconography did the Illithid have around it? And I got everybody to roll insight again, and I say, so there's a few things going on here. Al is missing critical details such as the name Gratzt, when the visions began, and who had them. However, you also remember something after his question. The Illithid, you recall, had six tentacles, which was unusual. That would probably qualify as a Gratzt connection, but if Al hasn't thought of Gratzt yet, he's probably not going to come up with that specific demon lord on his own. And so, Hex explains, we fought demons in Citra-Akra around an altar of Gratzt. We have reason to believe he has made a play for Citra-Akra and is now maneuvering on the material plane. Al thinks to himself again. He re-examines the tentacle rod, which seems to be tightening its appendages to itself as though trying to become smaller. Finally, he claps his hands. All right, how about this? The Illithid was a warlock of Gratzt. Alistair is a warlock of Mephisto, right? So he sends you to take out an enemy warlock. I've never heard of an Illithid warlock, but I mean, you're looking for a connection that's barely there. There were no demons around this Illithid, right? And Hex says, there were eggs and a frozen chest and those strange alien warriors, and there was that Empok scout. And Al nods slowly, says, so basically Illithid things. Nothing out of ordinary for an Illithid op, I would say, but the absence of demons is the point that stands out. If the Illithid was mutated, that implies it was the demonic connection, which would explain why Alistair ordered you to kill it in the first place. In fact, now that I think of it, I think that tentacle rod we have at the Pandemonic Goblin Archive is a Warlock's Pact rod as well. Maybe this is the same sort of thing. A demonic mutant spell focus for a demonic mutant Illithid. And Gent perks up at the idea of the Warlock Pact and says, come again? And he says, well, if the Illithid was mutated to have six tentacles, and there's a sacred number to Gratz, and then the Illithid has what might be a pact rod, going by other examples I've seen like this, then I suspect the Illithid was a Warlock of Gratz. Gent says, and the rod would be their conduit or connection to him? A focus of the power Gratz bestowed upon them, certainly. And Hex says, okay, so what we've landed on is Alistair probably knows more about what's going on than we do, and that he was probably a good guy. Hex gives Gent a look. He says, ha, good is relative here, but I mean, acting against a demonic warlock, even if it was just on orders from his own patron, is standard operating procedure for a guy like him at this point. And Gent says, what I gather is that we are only being told half the story and almost getting killed in the process. And Al says, I don't think there's any indication that Mephisto has our best interests at heart, but we may happen to have some mutual enemies. And Hex says, all right, well, that's something to go on at least. This thing has a connection to Gratz power, which could be causing your freaky dreams. You haven't been, like, keeping it under your pillow, have you? And Gent says, I keep many things under my pillow. Gent motions for the rod back. Thank you for your answers. I still wish to be discreet about this. And Hex says, well, it seems like some kind of powerful artifact. Maybe best to stay guarded around it? Gratz is supposed to be pretty devious. And Al passes the rod back and says, hope you know what you're doing with this. Hex says, thanks for this, Al. Oh, did we give you those rocks already? Any idea why Agilochians were trading in them? And Al Samasath shrugs. Honestly, there's been so much going on in preparing for the offensive. I've mostly been helping Wenton and Elianu get the brain caps ready for our troops so they don't go stark raving mad in that damn forest. However, I also put a little note that on the plus side, the operation with the Illithid is no longer an outlier in Gent's conspiracy wall. Now all the operations have some kind of apparent connection to Gratz. And Al Samasis says, speaking of, I better get back to it. Let me know if you need any more help, though. And so, at that point, they depart for the briefing room. Returning to the briefing room, they find that it's been cleared out once more. There are noticeable changes since yesterday. The map of Agaloc behind Coyote has been marked up considerably, and the map dominating the briefing room table is littered with tokens suggesting different military strategies. Empty cups rest on the table around the map, and reports are strewn around between the spots where Coyote, Morgar, and Gog had been standing. Coyote looks tired, but greets them all enthusiastically. Welcome back, agents. Ready to join the Draelic offensive? And Hex says, about that time, I suppose. And Gent nods. Coyote hands them each a small document entitled Operation Failing Moon. Not enough to warrant a dossier this time. Coyote explains, just a rundown indicating the chain of command to help you know who to look to in the field. Sure enough, the document simply lists a series of names, titles, and brief descriptions of their battlefield role. Commander Gog and Morgar are at the top. Any questions? Hex looks down at the map. Where are we going in? We've set up a staging area on the perimeter. From there, my understanding is that the army will enter the forest and move to different points within based on their battlefield role. And Hex says, understood. Are you holding down back here at the base? Coyote is quiet for a moment as if thinking to himself, one hand in his pocket. He then says, Morgar and Gog haven't left the base yet. You should be able to find them outside the showers. They'll give you the specifics on your mission. If you like, you can probably accompany them to the front. Coyote nods. Still plenty of intel to compile here, and they'll need me to be informing them in the field, so no breaks around the base just yet. And Hex says, be on guard, Coyote. Something is stirring. And Coyote takes a moment to appreciate that and says, I've gotten that implication. I guess the good news is that Odium should have his big plan to take down the Night Side soon. We just have to hold out till then. And Gent just says, side note, something a little homoerotic about burly orcs hanging around the showers. They are now dating. And so Hex says, yeah, I was wondering if we should show up late or early. And Coyote gives them all another salute. Good luck, agents! And he says, or like, if we're meeting up out front so they can do like a shower briefing. And Gent says, no one can be bugged if we are all naked in the showers, like the Russian mob in the bathhouse. Gent will take a quick look at the documents on the table before leaving the room. Anything interesting? With an investigate roll of 17, I say, It's hard to tell much more than what Coyote has informed you about the mission. There are a lot of indicators of what units will be dispatched where, but so many lines and markers have been laid over each other on the maps that you can't really tell which is which anymore. You just recognize the staging area and then the approach into the forest plan beyond that. And on their way to meet Gog and Morgar, I say that they can stop by the labs and armory if they desire, and which is funny because they were just at the labs and armory when they saw Al-Samasath. But I as
let's go back.
As a clever DM, I knew that they hadn't done their armory shopping yet. So, you know, I put it in there. And of course, Alex says, yeah, Hex could use a new C4. I hardly used any ammo on that last mission, though, unless I marked it wrong. Connor might as well pick up a box of shells, too. And Jenk grabs some more ammo. And so they Jent says, yeah, I should get more ammo. And I say, you have two out of seven shots in your current clip and two more seven shot clips currently. And Jent says, okay, so yes, I know barely anything about guns, so what you think would be an appropriate amount of ammo I will grab. And Alex says, two more mags? Should be enough to last, that's like 30 turns of shooting. And I think you do more melee stuff generally. And Jent says, cool, done and done. I am that rich bitch who says, money is no option. So Jent buys a couple of clips, and which I'm pretty sure my brother is like correctly using the term mag there, which I think is it's supposed to be mags, not clips. Whatever. Showing my true ignorance. Hex and Connor go splitsies on the C4. Connor grabs two boxes of shells. And so they continue and they see Morgar standing in a corridor up ahead, soldiers in plainclothes filing past him into a chamber from which steam flows thickly in the air. Morgar himself is still fastening his armor, his long black hair still wet over his green shoulders, and the scarlet cloak of the Draelic military. As the group approaches, Morgar offers a salute. "Empok's finest," he says with a smile. "Of course, I remember the first team that carried that title. I think it's safe to say it's yours now." And Hex says, "Reporting for duty, sir." Morgar calls back into the showers. "Gog, you done?" And heavy, wet footfalls approach in response, shaking the ground with each splashing slap. Gog emerges from the showers, all the soldiers standing clear of the entrance to give him space. The glistening ogre wears a fresh loincloth and is idly scrubbing his back with a large curved bone that has soapy sponges strapped to the end. He smells a bit like a wet dog. Jent's eyes are wide. "Yeah, you're done," Morgar says. "No more smell like victory?" Gog says. Morgar gives the ogre a pat on the arm and says, "Not old victory, new victory." And Gog smiles and nods confidently. They then turn their attention to you. "Thanks to your success in taking out their leadership, we have a distinct advantage over their mantle that we need to press immediately," Morgar begins to explain. "Unfortunately, the mantle itself is going to be on high alert due to the crisis that they're now facing. While they're hunkering down in the capital, we're going to hit them in the places they won't be. Specifically, Ashgrain Outpost, their slave-powered industrial breadbasket." Hexakila says, "Seems wise." And he says, "Both the Mantle and Ashgrain Outpost are deep in the forest, so just getting into position is going to make up a significant portion of this operation. We'll start from the Draelic perimeter, naturally. If you like, your vehicles can accompany my armored car when Gog and I head to the front ourselves." Morgar clears his throat. "Once there, we'll assess the present situation and stock up on necessary supplies. We'll determine your first objectives then in accordance with the tactical assessment. Any questions?" Jent says, "None for me," and Hex says, "Sounds good." And, "Gog?" Morgar props the ogre. Gog just stands there, blinking. "Huh?" Morgar shakes his head. "Tell them about the potential strategic asset in the forest." The ogre slowly repeats, "Potential strategic..." Morgar rephrases. "Your old friend that might be able to help us?" Gog smiles. "Oh yeah!" The ogre finally begins addressing the group. "I know a dragon!" The ogre announces proudly. Morgar facepalms and asks, "What was its name?" "Was Cub?" "Cub? Its name was Cub?" Morgar asks. "Was Little Dragon?" Gog says. "So it was a dragon cub, or Was it a dragon named Cub? Gog shrugs. Was a little dragon Cub friend? Morgar shakes his head and shrugs, sighing as he says, All right, so when was the last time you saw them? When in forest, Gog says. Right, you were in the jungle and the dragon went into the forest. Yep, no seen Cub since, Gog replies. Great, thanks, Gog. Gog smiles. Morgar then begins to address the group as if Gog is not there. Basically, as I understand it, this dragon friend that Gog made went from the jungles into Agalloch. I'm not going to bother getting into the specifics out of him, or glances at Gog, but I was made to understand that this didn't happen too long ago. My thinking is that if the dragon isn't dead, it may be a potential ally. Something to keep in mind when you're in the field, yeah? And, Gent asks, what color was the dragon? And Gog says, shiny! And Morgar says, is shiny a color, Gog? And Gog thinks for a long time. Shiny brown? And Morgar says, that narrows it down a bit, at least. Maybe bronze, maybe brass, maybe copper. Not an expert on dragons myself. Are there iron dragons? And, then...
I'm gonna go with no. I mean, I know it wasn't a question to me, but... Are there iron dragons? I don't think there are.
I'm sure in some supplement they've got iron dragons, but, like, not in the general cast.
Probably.
You know, they've got all those Draconomicons and whatnot that are just full of all the different dragons there could be. Hexakila, at the discussion of dragons, thinks of that shadow dragon that they met on the caravan trail, Kitty. Do you remember that?
I'm gonna go with no, but mainly because I've distracted looking up iron dragons, which are a thing.
Okay, well, back when they were doing the caravan trail in the Deathlands, one of the stops they made was they met a dragon that was like sort of the unofficial ruler of like the area of Beargate Lake. Was a shadow dragon named Kitty. She wanted to meet, like, they arranged a meeting between Kitty and Atuin at Kitty's request. But anyways, this just, like, jogs Hex's memory. And so Hex says, Gog, did Dragon Cub mention Dragon Kitty? And Gog thinks, then shakes his head. And Jed says, so we should definitely be on the lookout. Anything else we should know? That's all, Morgar confirms. And the group has multiple options for getting to the Draelic front, from their land vehicles to their aircraft to the teleportation chamber. And I asked how they would like to get there. Hex says, I feel like we never use our fighter jet, but I think we should stick to the Jeep and the Genter cycle. And I say, makes sense. This will allow you to accompany Morgar and Gog to the front. And... that is where we broke. I said, we'll pick up next time at the beginning of the op with you guys arriving at the Draelic front. And you know what's funny is I remember way back I read that passage about Gog coming out of the showers on this very podcast back when I ran it. Because it was something that I was kind of proud of. I'm not even sure if I read on the podcast. I may have just read it to you after the podcast.
To me, I think. Yeah, I think that's likely.
And, yeah, I've also got some pictures here. We got a picture of Coyote with a cigar. And then
We
got a picture of Al-Samasath. And these are pictures that I've shown before, but, you know. Characters that were relevant to the session.
These are classics.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have remarked on it before too about how we're looping back on it, man. We're looping back around to what was going on in your game at the time when the podcast started.
Yeah. Well into it at this point. So, that's my side of the podcast, and now I'm ready for yours. Unless you have any further questions or comments on that whole, like, you know, it was just another one of those classic briefing sessions with some downtime learning. I mean, I did like you know, that note that I sort of hit that, like, okay, we were originally going into this with a sort of missing piece of the puzzle, which was, like, what was the connection of that Illithid mission to everything else? But now they have sort of an idea going forward of, like, okay, everything kind of fits.
My only comment is...
Not me.
That's right. Over to the RPG Danger Room. Gosh. We'll see how much time I spend on this, because I feel like... I don't know how to approach this one, Tom. I guess the first thing I should do is just talk about the game itself. I'm going to talk about this game, Wicked Ones, which was designed by Ben Nielsen, with illustrations by Victor Costa, and consultation by Cass Ray, and it is a forged-in-the-dark game. You said you were really excited about this.
I love me a forged-in-the-dark.
I bet I know why. So it's forged-in-the-dark. Did you look into it any more than that?
It's like, oh boy, it's like my favorite, the old classic... you know, I love the old Dungeon Keeper. I love Dungeon Keeper.
That's exactly what it is.
The twist around where you're the dungeon monsters and everything instead of being the hero that goes into the dungeon. And yeah, this is like that, but it's a Forged in the Dark game.
That's exactly it. And it's pretty explicitly based on the ideas from Dungeon Keeper. And the premise is that the players are all... they're a gang of monsters... and they have their own dungeon, and the gameplay loop is them sort of plotting their own schemes, and then also defending their dungeon against adventurers who are coming to try and slay them. And part of the gameplay is quite literally like laying out and designing your dungeon, which is very Dungeon Keeper. And I came upon this because, as always, you know, I'm searching for new and interesting RPGs for us to talk about. And for one thing, I really like free RPG systems. I always think it's super cool when RPG systems are given away for free. And I mean, obviously, games like, you know, D&D, you can get the SRD, the stripped down basic rules. But in the case of Wicked Ones, the whole document is free on DriveThruRPG. It is a 342-page free edition source book for Wicked Ones, and there is a deluxe print edition that I believe comes with more character scenarios and character books, but like everything you need to play is in the free edition, Wicked Ones version 1.4. Just available for $0.00 on DriveThruRPG, and I love this thing. I wish I had had more time to go through it before this show, but you better believe that we're going to be covering a lot of different parts of it. But starting off, though, I'm trying to think of how much we've talked about Forged in the Dark on the show, like the actual... how the gameplay actually functions, because obviously you and I have we've been playing in an ongoing game of Teeth that you've been running, which is itself a Forged in the Dark system, but I don't know, have we even really talked about it that much? We spend more time on like City of Mist than anything Forged in the Dark.
Yeah, one thing I definitely did talk about on the podcast was the notion, because it was something that I had pointed out on the podcast that you would not have insight into because you were only on the player side of Teeth, was the fact that like the enemies don't roll in a Forged in the Dark game. Like there's no monster roll to attack. Your failure is what, like rolling a failure is what causes you to take harm. Like you don't, You make a roll and you either succeed and you do your thing, or you get a mixed success and you succeed and get a complication, or you fail and something bad happens. But that never happens for the NPCs or the enemy characters. It's all on you, And so that role is entirely like reflecting not just your skill, but like how well things turn out for you.
Now, we also played a game that you ran of Cyberpunk, which we talked about on the show, I know. Is that true of the Cyberpunk system as well?
Yes.
Because that's another case where I was just viewing it from the player's perspective.
Yes. One thing that I generally do is I have it so that it's like in combat when it's happening, you know, there is that rule of the bad guys never roll for their attacks. Like you take damage, or like you will take damage if you roll a failure on your roll, if you roll badly. But the other thing that I do is I also do like sort of an attrition effect a lot of the time, where if an enemy is not taken out once we've done the full round of all the players going through, then I also hit somebody with a harm effect as a result of that. And all of this is like, at that point, the players, it's up to them to like either use armor or resistance or simply take the hit.
So I will say that a key difference with Wicked Ones from these other Forged in the Dark systems that I have played and we've talked about is that it seems like player character death is a lot more present in this one. And of course it would be. The players are playing as monsters running a dungeon, and one of the ongoing threats they face are adventurers coming to kill them, to navigate their dungeon and eventually kill them. So it's entirely possible for a player character to die, and it seems like much more easily than in other Forged in the Dark systems, which I think makes perfect sense to me.
Is that because they just have less harm blocks to spare, or?
I believe so. I mostly read that in a game overview. It just seems like they have, yeah, fewer blocks to spare. And then also there are other potential elements to the game that could lead to player characters dying, because there is a cycle of play, like it seems like all Forged in the Dark games. I know in Teeth especially, we have that cycle of play with the different phases. And two of the phases in the cycle of play for Wicked Ones are Calamity and Blowback. Calamity describes mishaps that could happen in the dungeon, and then Blowback is mishaps as the result of the monsters following their plans, like their wicked designs, and seeing them through. And there is, on top of all that, an element of chaos as well with dark impulses. So I guess maybe now is a good time to like really get into how this works. Something I found really interesting about this is that Wicked Ones does not have a pre-designed singular setting. You know, another key difference here from the likes of Cyberpunk and Teeth is both of those games have very defined settings. The Cyberpunk world, Teeth is a sort of a like a Lovecraftian kind of a world. Reminds me a lot of the game Darkest Dungeon.
Well, and Teeth is very specific about its location. Like Teeth has a very specific mm-hmm. map and an area of play that you really drill down into. And it's interesting because I find a lot of Forged in the Dark games really thrive on that specificity. Blades in the Dark in particular has a very well-realized like steampunk sort of city that's like a lot of the character of the game comes through in that setting. But anyways, I'm interested to hear about this seemingly less setting-driven. What's going on here?
Sandboxes are what it's called. Sandboxes, not settings. And I'll read this blurb straight from the source book. While it is assumed that your story is taking place in a fantasy world, there is no base setting for Wicked Ones. It takes place in a dungeon. So with a dungeon, what's most important is its immediate vicinity, as it's inextricably tied to the region surrounding it. But the players work together with the GM to craft a sandbox, a map full of factions and points of interest for the dungeon to get involved with. The point is to make it a pressure cooker, where many actions, where any action you take is bound to have some blowback. And there are suggested sandbox maps in the source book. And you know what? Let me just skip to one right now so that I can give a sample of it. Where are my sandboxes? Here we go. So the idea of creating a sandbox, and it's this collaborative thing that all the players take part in. A dungeon exists in a localized region. Its static nature means it can only affect a limited area. You work together to create a sandbox, which is a small region full of dominoes for you to knock over. First, you choose a map, whether one from the source book or from somewhere else. Then you define a series of light, neutral, and dark factions existing within the map. This gives each player input on the type of factions they want to interact with. It's important that the region is local. Keep the travel distance from the dungeon to the edge of the map about 2 to 4 days maximum. The Wicked Ones can't spend long periods of time away from the dungeon. Giving minions such an opportunity would perhaps allow them to turn against you. Your horde would surely be raided while you're gone. So your map is like not just your base of operations. It is your home. It is your fortress. Once you have your map, you fill it with factions, the groups that inhabit and control points on the map. Factions, light factions, dark factions, and neutral factions. So light factions are usually the standard D&D base races for player characters. Humans, elves, dwarves, halflings, things like that. Light factions speak a common tongue. Then there's a dark faction. You know, dark factions consist of the monster races, bugbears, goblins, orcs, trolls, ogres, troglodytes, hobgoblins, things like that. They also speak their own common tongue, the dark tongue. So there's the light tongue and the dark tongue. And then neutral factions are races that don't really get placed in the either of those two groups, you know, like lizard folk or dryads or giants. Neutral factions can speak their own language or any of the other common tongues. And it's not so much about describing them as good or evil. It really is like light or dark or monstrous and civilized, you know, that sort of idea. And then there are four different tiers of factions. Actually, I guess five different tiers of factions, starting with tier zero. Factions are rated from tier zero to tier four, depending on their size and the threat they represent. And so here are just some sample ones. A tier zero faction could be like displaced kobolds in a tiny forest shrine. A tier one faction could be a traveler's tavern, farmers around the walled town, a goblin tribe. Tier 2 factions, woods filled with fey, hill trolls, and forest rangers attached to a garrison. Tier 3 factions are a reclusive wizard's tower, a colony of gargoyles, a riverside town. And then tier 4 factions are like a big orc tribe, a walled town with a few hundred people, a garrison of a duke's soldiers from far away. And this system uses the clocks that you described from Teeth. Are those also in Cyberpunk?
Cyberpunk, they typically are not drawn as clocks, which, but in Blades in the Dark, they're drawn as clocks. Like clocks are like a pretty major part of Forged in the Dark.
Yeah, exactly. And so this implements the clock system as well, where between each session, no matter how the cycle of play is progressing, the GM rolls the faction's tier and ticks away their clocks, representing progress towards their goals, simulating the world moving forward. When the clocks fill up, the goal is realized, the GM brings this new situation into play, and the goals of the factions generally focus on interactions with other factions or the dungeon. When a faction clock brings them up against another faction, their opposed roles, and then events within the game might also tick away the clocks, sort of at the GM's discretion. And the book also contains a lot of like pre-made sandboxes that you can play with that even have like the different clocks for the factions written into the boxes. So like, as an example, if you're playing in the Quiet Valley, there is a tier one faction of Fangtooth Goblins. They're hungry cannibals that zealously worship Labisha, the goddess Labisha, and they have pit traps all around the woods. They have a four-section clock, their goal being eating the wood gnomes, and then they have a six-section clock with the goal being kidnapping the town priest. Meanwhile, down in the town that the Fangtooth Goblins live outside of, there is a faction that's a tier four faction in Woodtown. Woodtown is run by a powerful mayor. He has a strong, loyal guard and wants to remain independent. And their two clocks, their goals are to wipe out the goblins and to request troop withdrawal. And there are, on top of all that, there are, what, six more different factions associated with the Quiet Valley Sandbox. And then there are questions that can act as adventure hooks. What haunts the Eastern Woods? What causes the ruined chapel's red glow? Why is the castle in ruins? And what danger lurks in the river? And there are all sorts of, there are a lot of these prefab settings. What's cool is that like each of these is sort of laid out like a spread on two pages, and they give you the map, and then separately they give you the map with all the notation and the factions and everything on it. So they even provide the materials, like what you can show your players and then what you have behind your screen with all the factions and what they apply to. And so one aspect that I really like about Wicked Ones, not only is the setting cool and it's fun that everybody gets to play as the monsters for a change, but it seems to really encourage collaboration in the creation of the game world. And not just in players and GM collaborating on the sandbox that they're going to be playing in, but the players also get to design their dungeon. And this is really where the dungeon keeper thing, like the aspects that, like the video game Dungeon Keeper, come into play. Because designing your dungeon, building it up, and then adding denizens, adding rooms to the layout, structures, traps, tricks, locks, and even a sanctum. All of these things are factored into it. And the idea here, you know, maybe a good place to sort of jump to from that idea, talking about designing the sandbox and designing the dungeon, would just be to talk about how it is worked into the game in terms of like how the GM runs a campaign of this. So like in session zero, that's where you choose the sandbox. The region the dungeon interacts with has a huge impact on the types of stories they'll be told. The PCs are probably new to the region without pre-existing connections to it, so the region can be revealed over time through play, and all the players, you know, decide on that together. And then you also choose a theme for your dungeon in session zero. The dungeon you build sets the tone for the entire campaign and can change the way you view the sandbox. It puts everyone on the same page about what kind of story you want to tell. And then outside of that, in session zero, it's more character-based stuff. Like, you know, what will the game be about? What are characters' callings and goals? Things of that nature. And then in session one is where, like, once the table is set, then in session one is where you sort of introduce the players and their characters into the sandbox. And because, of course, they're all supposed to be new to the region. And so, like, session one, the section in the source book has some text here that even suggests how to do it. You're all members of a failed dungeon, one that collapsed in upon itself after your master was overthrown by an adventuring party. The dungeon was ransacked, and the remnants of the minions and creatures tore each other apart in the aftermath as they struggled for control. While you never really knew each other before, in the ensuing chaos, you escaped from the doomed dungeon and recognized that each of you has the spark of a Wicked One, a monster that can suppress its dark impulses long enough to work towards a master plan together. Since then, you've been on the run through civilized territory looking for the right spot for a dungeon. Now you're huddled around a dying campfire under a tree as rain pours around you, soaked, cold, tired, pretty angry. Have the players describe their characters. They give you the introduction scene where everybody gets to introduce themselves. And then you get to sort of start to decide on what the dungeon is like. As you sit there watching the fire, your thoughts turn towards what your future dungeon will be like. All of the monsters are like, man, that last dungeon sucked. We got to make a new one. So the GM, I'm going to ask you all some questions to set the atmosphere of the dungeon you might all like to play someday. Let's answer them in character. Feel free to disagree. Monsters are sure to have strong opinions. And then there are dungeon atmosphere questions to help zero in on what the dungeon is going to be like. And it's okay for the PCs to argue because they're monsters. But the GM should take notes on questions like, what will the dungeon's entrance look like from the outside? What will the floors and walls of the dungeon be like? What will lighting be like inside the dungeon? What smell will greet those who step foot into the dungeon? And what will your horde consist of? So let's actually skip over to some dungeon stuff here, and maybe we can look a little closer to that. I'm kind of like hopping around, but it's hard to tell with something based on a system we've already covered, like how much I actually need to go into any of these things. So like, I don't know, man, hop in if you have any questions about stuff that I'm talking about. So everyone works together to choose a master plan, or at least detail the first steps of a plan that develops over time through play, and everybody is working towards this. The plan always has to start the same, gathering a horde. You gain XP when you work towards each step, and then the final plan emerges from these steps and gives your group a goal to strive towards. Dungeon creation. So, you work together as a group to decide all the details of the dungeon you will live in and then actually draw it out on a dungeon sheet. It grows over time.
Yes, I have the initial setup. Are you supposed to have picked your playbook before this?
Yes. The dungeon creation happens in game, basically. So first, everybody makes their characters, like, picks their playbooks, becomes a wicked one.
Can I learn about the playbooks?
Absolutely. So before we even get to the dungeon, then, let's talk a bit about the characters.
Hell yeah.
So, the idea behind the wicked ones is that they are representatives of different species of monsters, but they are like enlightened a little bit. The base monsters of the world of wicked ones are very feral, and they're ruled by something called dark impulses. Dark impulses are basically they're kind of like madness effects in a way. Like if your character takes too much stress, they might go berserk and tap into their monstrous nature and do something crazy, you know, like an orc might have a dark impulse to just tear people apart limb from limb when they get too stressed out.
So the other comparison points would be like, so in Blades in the Dark, if you max out your stress, you gain trauma, which you then sort of affects your character, or you get XP if you reflect that in your character. In Teeth, you gain erratic behaviors, which we've already seen happen a few times in our game. And so in this one, if you max out your stress, you pick up a dark impulse, or a dark impulse takes control?
Yeah, basically. So the list of dark impulse, there's a list of dark impulses, and then you can choose one that best describes what pulls your character's attention. You know, and some examples are big mouth, cruel, deranged, fickle, obsessed, paranoid, reckless, and vengeful. And then there are also revelries that choose how your character likes to blow off steam. This is very similar to Teeth.
Your vice.
Yeah, your vice. So craving, drinking, gambling, occult, violence, and worship. I think some of those might actually be identical even to the ones that are listed in Teeth.
I think gambling occurs in Blades in the Dark, Teeth, and this one.
Yeah, and occult is definitely in Teeth, because I'm pretty sure my character has it. I think, yeah.
Well, there's weird.
Weird. Yeah, that's right. Similar idea. So yeah, that's the idea, is that all the players are members of these monstrous races that have enlightened to a degree that they are not totally ruled by their dark impulses the way other creature races are. There are some broad rules here for creating your party, your player group. For example, everybody should probably be the same race, just to avoid conflict between different monstrous races. So, you know, you could all be bugbears, something like that. Keep it simple. All PCs must be humanoid, with two arms and two legs. Nothing bigger than a bugbear or smaller than a kobold. PCs must be members of a specific monster race, perfect for a highly themed dungeon. And then after that, anything goes. I'm giving conflicting information. I'm going to cut all that out. What I meant to say was, you choose one of these options. Keep it simple. All PCs must be humanoid with two arms and two legs. Or, we're all family. Everybody has to be a specific monster race. Or, anything goes. PCs are free to play as anything, from oozes to mushroom people to magically awakened evil squirrels.
Yeah, I was going to say, I definitely go with anything goes, because, like, who wants to all be the same thing? Not me.
Well, I mean, it all depends. Thematically, it might be fun to all play as the same thing. Like, you are all, you know, denizens of a previous dungeon, and now you're out on your butts trying to find your way in
the world.
I think
it's still cooler if you do that, but you're different races.
Sure. This is a decision that you would make with the other players and your GM. The choice of race, though, should have as little mechanical effect as possible. Because while race can be considered as a circumstance towards position and effect, it's best to use this in the most obvious or extreme cases. Allowing players a wide range of choice, like a hulking kobold or a sneaky orc, makes for more interesting characters and satisfied players. But they shouldn't be too mechanically different. If a race has a unique ability beyond being a bipedal creature that functions as a human, it's represented in the following two ways. Primal monsters are monsters with multiple unique abilities or require gameplay changes that fundamentally alter how they interact with the game's core mechanics. And for monsters that have a unique ability that other monsters can't do but don't require extensive mechanical changes, you can take primal ability, which is something mentioned later on, to bring them into play, detailed later in this chapter. So, you know, you don't want the different races of monsters to be too different in terms of how they work within the game. I'm guessing just for, like, simplicity's sake. But there are rules if you want to play as something with, like, a lot of special abilities. When setting up a dungeon, it's recommended that all the PCs be new to the area. So the backstory has to be light on details. And the idea is that, like, everybody's just showing up for the first time. There's a plethora of fantasy monster races that work just fine as PCs, but, you know, they have the six base ones here that they suggest, and the GM can then make the final call, and you can work with the players. The basic ones that they suggest are bugbear, demon, goblin, kobold, orc, slissick. Slissick is snake people that are specific to this game, and then they also say, or your own idea. All monster factions speak a common language called the Dark Tongue. Civilized factions speak the Light Tongue. Neutral factions might know one, both, neither. It's rare for a member of a civilized faction to know the Dark Tongue or a monster to know the Light Tongue. PCs can learn the Light Tongue with an ability from one of the different playbooks. There are a few exceptions. And then there's a rough guide on how much Light Tongue a PC knows, which is funny because the guide is just like clusters of basic words. Like, a monster might know you, me, us, and it in the Light Tongue, or yes, no, maybe, and now. So I like that they give you just like the most rudimentary Light Tongue words that your character can speak. And then, yeah, then we're on to character creation.
Yeah, this group to be a whole monster mash. I want it to be, like, a skeleton, a wolfman, and, I don't know, something else.
All right. Well, let's get you this source book though. I'm just amazed that this is free. Like talk about awesome that the group Bandit Camp produces that. It's so cool that they put this out into the world for free, because like this is a full-fledged RPG.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it, all them pages. But when you download it, it has Wicked One's Undead Awakening, where you lead a powerful undead and their hordes of skeletons and zombies against a region. So that's what I was talking about with the skeleton. Also, I was going to mention, like, these days, Dungeon Keeper's so old, most of these people know different games, like Dungeon World or whatever, or more specifically, War for the Overworld, I was thinking of, and I was like, what is War for the Overworld? But it says right here, Wicked One's War for the Overworld, an adaptation of the Dungeon Builder video game.
Well, there we go.
And then they've also got Wicked One's solo rules, allowing you to build a dungeon by yourself. Yep.
Yeah, I was going to get to those because I figured those would appeal to you very much so. I could see you building your own dungeon using all this. Choose a monster race. You can see options are available a couple of pages later. And of course, you can create your own as well. I leave it up to you. My inclination is always to go straight from the rule book for the samples, but you know, Tom, you can get crazy.
Yeah, I'm like...
You can see the Slissix, the snake people that are they created for this RPG are down near the bottom there that I like.
I mean, I think I'll just go skeletons. I'm a skeleton.
Classic skeleton. What? Not goblin?
I really considered it. They even have goblins right here. So obvious.
Look, the goblins even have sample Tom Lando quotes. Hey, don't look. I said, don't look at me.
Ah, not me.
What's mine is mine, and what's ours is mine.
Sounds like a fair fight. Let's get the hell out of here.
Exactly. And look at that. Look in the common names, Tom.
One of them is There's Remy. Name,
one of them is Remy.
Man, where are the odds?
They even have a goblin named Remy.
All right, fine. I'll be a goblin.
Yeah. All right. So you are a goblin. Now you choose a calling, and these are the playbooks. Brute, Conniver, Crafter, Hunter, Marauder, Shadow, Shaman, Warlock, and Zealot. And if you want to skim through the playbooks, you can skip ahead to page 94 when they start. And in a nutshell, each of the callings, which are effectively the character classes, they provide you with the core, your core ability, flashbacks that let you flashback and perform actions in the past, calling abilities that let you customize what type of member of your calling you are, and flexibility slot, which lets you take a single calling ability from another playbook, another callings list. You can't take a core ability with this. Some abilities allow you to spend stress to perform incredible feats. If a normal monster can do something with an action rule, spending stress allows you to either automatically accomplish it or put you on equal footing. Again, this stress system sounds exactly the same as the way it functions in Teeth, from my experience anyway.
Yeah,
And brutes seem sort of like barbarian types. Conniving, you know, the connivers are more like, you know, charisma, some kind of charisma based character. Crafters are, of course, tinkerers. Hunters are trackers. They seem sort of like rangers. Marauders. Marauders could also be seen as barbarians, but also sort of like maybe fighters. Shadows.
I'm going to go with shaman.
Basically rogues. Yeah, shaman are terrifying and vengeful witches. Warlocks are ambitious mages, and then zealots are fervent mystical believers. They're sort of like dark clerics, I guess. So you're going with the shaman. they're sort of like dark druids in a way, and their core ability is witchcraft. You have mastered a magic path. Choose one of the following: blood reading, soothsaying, spirit calling, storm strike, or wild heart. And then you can spend stress to invoke tier 2 and tier 3 spells of your path. They also give you some rules here on flashbacks. I like the suggestions for flashbacks. You can flashback to things a shaman would have thought to do, like interacting with spirits or animals, brewing a wild concoction, or sowing terror.
Yeah, that's so I really like that good idea. I like providing like playbook-based flashback examples.
Exactly, and having them be sort of such handy things. Like, I can really see being in a game of Wicked Ones playing a shaman and being like, oh, but it just so happens that I anticipated this earlier today and brewed a potion for this situation. I'm going to flash back to when I brewed that potion, and then I have it at the ready in the present.
You can do that in Teeth with Spilly.
Oh, absolutely I could, but as you said, it doesn't, Teeth doesn't have
it.
Sort of the, exactly, it doesn't have the ready provided write-up on it, which I think is very clever. It's a very smart thing to include. And then shaman abilities, things like beast form is a wild shape, effectively. Bonded spirit, you have magically bonded spirit or pack instead of minions. It's like having a familiar. Spirit whispers, your control of chaotic situations pulls information from surrounding spirits. It's almost like a talk to plants kind of thing. Terror, others can't help but reveal their fears. You can spend stress to figure out what someone's worst fear is. Weaving, you can blend witchcraft with the material or mundane. On a success when casting a spell, you add one die on any follow-up using a different action. Wild brews, you can, of course, make potions. And then wrath, your desire for payback fuels your witchcraft. When you cast a spell immediately after resistance roll, you take +1 die, and it costs no stress to cast. And then there are example items that your shaman can have, things like a spirit mask, a bone mace, a thorn amulet, a jar of fireflies. This, again, feels like extremely similar to just the basic setup of a character in Teeth, where you have like the prefab loadout options, and then you can also create more as well. I love the abilities they have here because they're all sort of in service of like jumping out and scaring the adventurers who are your enemies. Like, you know, oh my god, there's a group of clerics, they're raiding our dungeon. Well, good thing that I have the terror ability, so I pop out and use my terror ability, and all the clerics reveal their worst fears to you so that I may then find a way to prey upon them.
With my witchcraft.
Pretty cool stuff. With your witchcraft.
My spirit calling.
So, now that you have chosen your calling, you choose your calling ability. You begin play with your calling's core ability and one calling ability from your calling's list.
So that's my witchcraft and then one of my shaman abilities?
That's correct.
So for witchcraft, I take spirit calling, not knowing what it is. And for abilities, I take beast form, because that's going to let All me right. potentially gain a primal ability.
Awesome. So you've chosen your calling abilities. When an ability requires you to choose a benefit, you decide when you take it. If it's a passive ability, if it's an ability that costs stress or works on a success, you make the choice each time you use it. Next, you choose your actions, and you don't really have a character sheet in front of you, but this is, again, very similar to the way it's laid out in Teeth, where you put 3 dots in a single action, what you're best at, 2 dots in 2 other actions, and then 1 dot in 2 other actions. So you have a sort of a spread of strengths and weaknesses, different abilities, or different actions, rather. Then you choose your dark impulse. So this is what I was talking about, where your dark impulses describe what pulls your character's attention. So you can find those on page 54. examples are Big Mouth, Cruel, Deranged, Fickle, Obsessed, Paranoid, Reckless, and Vengeful. So like Big Mouth, you just can't shut up. Whether you're obnoxiously rude or a braggart or a nonstop liar, you just cannot help but blab. You know, Cruel, you're kind of sadistic.
I think I'm going to go Deranged.
You find joy in the most bizarre, disturbing things. You either don't care or don't realize how your derangement affects those around you. I love it. You might hear voices that push you towards these actions, or maybe it's just curiosity. You find a potion with a label or without a label, and you just take a swig. You kick your minions down the hole to see what's down there. Grab a dog by its tail and toss it at the farmers. These are very appropriate for a goblin character,
I would say. Goblin shaman.
Yeah. And then there are dark hearts that are bankable dice earned when you play into your dark impulse. When you spend loot on revelry or from calling abilities. You get one dark heart immediately upon choosing your dark impulse. And you can have a maximum of two dark hearts, losing any extra that you earn. And then you can spend a dark heart and take an extra die on an action or resistant roll. You can only spend one dark heart per roll. So they're kind of like action dice, inspiration in a way. Just like these bankable dice that you can then use and apply to future rolls. Then we've got to choose your revelry, which is how your character likes to blow off steam. It's similar to those vices. And you can find those on page 235. It's a pretty short list, though. Craving, drinking, gambling, occult, violence, and worship. So, you know, craving is like strong desires that must be quelled, like food and flesh. Drinking, you just can't turn down a drink. Gambling, you love tossing dice. Occult, you can't help but involve yourself with strange supernatural forces. Violence, you love brawling, torture, or hurting others. And worship, you find comfort in worshiping your dark god.
I'm gonna go with worship.
Nice, all right. So when you're not chaotically, you know, doing chaotic things, you are seeking solace by praying to your god. And then you get to pick your gear, which is on page 70. You get four items as your gear, the things that you always carry on you. And then you choose another three items that you begin with in your supply. And each calling has a list of example items that I mentioned before. One of the items you choose can be a valuable item. You can also take one gold instead of the valuable item. You can choose to fill out your gear and supply later as it comes up. Again, similar to sort of picking your loadout. There are a lot of options here.
So what, do I just make up some stuff?
Sure, yeah. Let's see here.
I got a spear, a feathered headdress, and a smoking pipe.
And you get one more.
Oh, sunglasses.
So, four items is your gear that you always carry on you and decide your gear defense. Let's take a look here. Sounds like most of them are actually, those are just like mundane ones, right?
I guess.
So, gear defense. Monsters tend to love their possessions, clearly favoring evil style over substance, but that doesn't mean that things chosen mostly for appearance are useless. You have a single defense based on the items you've chosen. It can be derived from a single item or multiple items working together. Gear only ever gives one defense total. Below are some example problems that might arise and gear that could give you a defense against those problems. For example, detection. You might wear a dark cloak, soft boots, or a mask. Wounds. You might have heavy armor, a shield, or a defensive weapon. Work with the GM to decide what defense your gear provides. Here's a sample. The prisoner breaks free and runs down the hallway. They're probably going to make it out of your dungeon. No, I'm going to use my defense against enemy movement. I quickly cut off their path with my spear and say, where do you think you're going? So it seems like of the items you listed, the spear is probably the most likely one to provide you with some sort of defense, right?
I don't know. I kind of want to go with the magic and use my headdress.
Okay, yeah. So, and it can be multiple items too. Like we could go magic, and we could say the headdress and the spear if you felt so inclined.
No.
All right. So a magic headdress, and what kind of defense would that provide? If it's a magic headdress, maybe it it provides like a degree of clairvoyance, like a spidey sense. When you wear it, you can sense when other people are around.
It provides protection from spirits or something, or magic, but that's the defense is magic.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So the defense magic. It says, you know, that list is just examples, and the defense can be anything you can connect with your gear. So when you select a defense, make sure it's not too narrow or too broad. It should come up about once a session, but not always. So, like, it's a magic defense, but is there, like, a particular kind of way it protects you against other people or enemies?
It's like a headdress of magic resistance.
Magic resistance, okay. So when a spell is cast against you, the headdress protects you from that.
Yeah. Protects me
from
magic.
Yeah, that works. That's good. All right. So protection from magic cast against you. So let's see here. We have our gear. We have our... Oh, yeah. You had your four core items that provided your defense. Your defense being a protection against magic from your headdress. And then there are another three items that you begin with in your supply. And that's just sort of like kind of whatever you feel like. None of these are going to provide a defense, but, you know, they will obviously have a utility at some point. And one of the items can be a valuable item with an edge, or, you know, a magic item, or three doses of a potion or something like that. Since you're not really writing this down, we don't necessarily have to decide on the other three items or which one is valuable. Unless you have an idea for it.
For what?
I guess that headdress is probably valuable, right?
I don't know. So I have to pick one valuable one?
No, it just can be. The idea is there are the four items that are like core that you always have on you. So I'm trying to remember all of them. There was the smoking pipe, sunglasses,
your headdress
and your spear.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And then you get three more items that are just ones that begin in your supply, but you don't always have them on you.
Oh, man. Probably a bunch of smoke bombs.
There we go.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. We don't have to spend so much on every detail.
And then the final step is you pick a vile friend.
Oh,
once your dungeon
yeah.
is established, you choose a monster in the region that you've made friends with during your initial setup. This vile friend gives you an easy way to connect to the world and can be paid for help, items, information, and so on. You know what this sounds like to me, Tom? This sounds exactly like the Psy Squatch from Ashes Against the Grain.
Really?
Well, yeah, because my character Nox, he was friends with the cryptid, the Psy Squatch, and he could go and ask the Psy Squatch for guidance and information, right?
Yeah, that's true. The thing is, this exists across Blades in the Dark, like across Forge in the Dark games. Like, you guys have your acquaintances. You haven't really used them so much in Teeth yet, but like Grant used his, the big lad.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, again, same sort of idea.
Are there examples for this provided anywhere?
Yeah, let me pull it up here. So the basic examples that they give are all just like, you know, monsters you might find in your dungeon. The imps are a common one here. Other dungeon creatures are mindless or unintelligent monsters that have chosen to live in your lair. And this one is just like totally free form. You know, it could be a python or something like that. And then you can also create creatures with this sort of remix chart that they have, or it's just really just like a word cloud on page 191. So you can pick like two traits from this list. You could say it's a clever, sneaky, and then name a monster from the pool they have there. So your vile friend could be a clever, sneaky basilisk.
What page is this on?
Page 191.
Oh, yeah, and I see here. Okay.
And then there's also like... there are mini sheets for minions that you can create. Minions are kind of like NPC characters as well. Or you can even have a minion that's an extension of a PC as sort of a secondary character. And the idea with the vile friend is it seems like they can just be like any of these things. You can have like a vile friend who's like your sidekick, but you could also have a vile friend that is just like a monster that lives in the dungeon. You know, like this... you could be friends with a corrosive, terrifying fire elemental.
Or a skeleton.
Or a skeleton, yeah, exactly. You want yours to be a skeleton?
Yeah, I want to be friends with a skeleton.
All right, there you go. Yeah, you get the best of both worlds. So the vile friend gives you an easy way to connect to the world. And... that's sort of it. Then we get into the playbooks from there. But you've got the basic outline of your character. I don't think you've given them a name yet. But you're goblin shaman with a magic headdress.
Yeah.
Blah.
Gotta give them a name?
Yeah, go for it.
Buzz.
Buzz. That's good. Buzz the goblin shaman. So now that you have a character, I figure next time we'll sort of get into just, you know, these other aspects of it. I really want to spend some time talking about creating the dungeon and like modifying it and building out on the dungeon, because to me that is the thing that most sets this apart from other RPGs and other Forged in the Dark games. The idea that you're perpetually like designing and refining your base as part of the gameplay loop.
It is one of my favorite things about certain other Forged in the Dark games, particularly Blades in the Dark and Scum and Villainy. In Blades in the Dark, because you are like a heist team, you are consistently managing your turf and expanding your turf to include new areas of territory. And in Scum and Villainy, the type of crew you choose determines the type of ship that you have, and then it's your ship that you're like constantly building on and everything.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, it's also something like I've had a big element of it in my Boots on the Ground game, where, you know, it's like an XCOM type of like base building mini game is like attached to the game as well.
And it seems like that is sort of a major part of Wicked Ones too. I mean, it's that dungeon keeper aspect of it. And we're going to dive into more of this on future episodes for sure, just because I want to get into it a bit more. And I promise, after Wicked Ones, we will talk about the gates.
Okay. Well, that seems like the episode. I'm excited to cover more of Wicked Ones. It's pretty great. I love the art, like I said, and if you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Compare and Campaign on Facebook, or if you want to see our supplemental materials and show notes, check us out on compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. that it?
Oh, man, that's it.
Not me. Take care, everybody.
Design yourself a dungeon.
Yeah.
Populate with monsters. And
fun.
Get ready for the people from the overworld to come peeping.